Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And we're going to start today with Cynthia, who lives in New Orleans. And Cynthia, what are you going to be doing tonight?
I am going to be participating in our neighborhood porch dinner party, and the first one is tonight at 6 o'clock, and they're going to go on every Wednesday night at 6, as long as necessary.
A porch dinner party? What's a porch dinner party?
A porch dinner party is when everybody brings whatever they're going to have for dinner out onto their porch at the same time and eats together separately. And it's suggested that if the budget allows that you order takeout from a local restaurant so that you can help support them. If not, you warm up the leftovers from the freezer and you bring them out to the porch with a libation of choice and toast your neighbors across the street and next door and up and down the neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, so I want to let folks know that Cynthia is Cynthia Scott, and who was up until recently a host at WNNO in New Orleans. So
that's correct.
Great to have a fellow radio person on. And you sent us a voicemail yesterday when we called out to On Point listeners to share stories of kindness with us. And we loved your story so much that we thought, now we're not just going to play the voicemail. We're going to have Cynthia on to share this with us. So how did you first hear about this idea in your neighborhood to have these porch dinners?
There is a neighborhood listserv. We have a neighborhood association. And if you sign up for the listserv, you get the daily messages of whatever's going on. And the idea actually was from Emily Barr, who is a writer and urban planner, and she's married to our Neighborhood Association president, Bo Jones, and it was her idea. They got it out immediately, and I just thought it was the greatest idea. And I started telling my neighbors about it because not everybody's on the listserv. There's a brand new neighbor who's moved in across the street, and he was sitting on his balcony, so I told him about it. And a lot of the neighbors do pass because people are getting out and walking as much as they can. So I just told everybody who passed my house.
You're like, you should do this tonight, 6 o'clock, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
But what is it about this idea that as soon as you saw it, you thought, yes, this is what we need in the neighborhood right now?
I've been so inspired by the Italians who come out on their balconies and all sing together. And we are a collective country, but certainly this city is more collective than most. And our immediate reaction to any adversity, and let me tell you, we've had a few, I'm sure you know, our immediate response is to hit the streets. We go out and throng the streets. We dance in the streets. We parade in the streets. There's a parade for every kind of excuse you can think of. Our immediate response is to club together. And of course, that's the last thing we're allowed to do now.
Yeah.
So any idea that brings people together separately is exciting to me. And I'm starting to get all kinds of other ideas, like how about a jam session? You know, my block alone, we have several professional musicians. We've got a drummer on the corner. We've got a blues guitarist two doors down. My husband is a jazz trumpet player. Next door neighbor's a bassist. If they all came out on their porches and played, it would sound crazy, it would sound fun.
I am so delighted that you said that, because I was actually just wondering, like, when are we going to start seeing these YouTube videos of New Orleans musicians jamming together from across the street from each other? If you can make that happen in your neighborhood, I would love to hear it. Okay, Cynthia?
Okay. All right. You're the first person. Just the other day, there was an article in the paper about three women who tried to get a dance thing going in the French Quarter. And they told their neighbors, and evidently only three of them showed up, but they marked off 6 feet on the street and they put on goofy outfits because that's what we do. We costume all the time. And they went out into the street and they did a dance. And everybody came out and watched them, and some of them danced, jiggled along on their balconies and stuff. But I'd like to get something like that going, because we're big dancers down here, too.
Well, Cynthia, as you know, this hour we're talking about kindness and how important it is and how to grow it, especially in the midst of a of a crisis or a disaster. For you personally, I mean, what does it mean to you that your neighborhood is finding new ways to show kindness to each other?
It's so heartening and touching. It's not surprising to me because I was here for Katrina. I was here for the BP oil spill. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do. We reach out. But what's touched me a lot is that people far flung from other parts of the country have been making contact with me and people I haven't heard from in a while. And I started doing that too, thinking, oh, there's somebody in, you know, Ohio I haven't talked to in a really long time. And so you text or you call. And the fingers are just encircling the globe. And that, to me, is bringing people together. And because we're all going through this. You know, it used to be that if somebody reads in the news, oh, something else has happened in New Orleans, I'll get a couple texts saying, like, oh, are you okay? Or, you know, somebody's in an ice storm in Minnesota. Are you okay? Do you have enough stuff? But this is everybody.
Yeah.
This is everybody around the world. I'm in close contact with my best friend who lives outside of Rome. And, you know, technology has allowed us to do that this time. And that it's using technology for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
That's been very sustaining for me because I really am trying to keep, you know, close to home as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, Cynthia Scott, joining us from New Orleans, formerly a Saturday host at WWNO, who sent us a voicemail yesterday when we asked On Point listeners to share acts of kindness with us. So I'm just so glad we got you on the phone to join us live, Cynthia. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's fun.
Well, we'll be raising...
I'm a big fan, Meghna.
Oh.
And tell Mary Louise she's all right in my book.
Well, you know what? I will send her an email, absolutely, because obviously she's in Washington and staying there.
Right.
And I'm in Boston, but...
She's a hero right now.
No kidding. Well, Cynthia, thank you so much. We'll be raising a glass to you in your neighborhood at 6 o'clock Eastern tonight.
All righty. And I'll let you know about the jam.
Yes,
session.
Do. Please do.
Okay.
So we want to dig more deeply into how... these various acts of kindness popping up in neighborhoods and communities around the world, as Cynthia said, why they are so particularly important now and what it's going to take to sustain them. So joining us from San Francisco is Jamil Zaki. He's professor of psychology at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab. He's also author of The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. Professor Zaki, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, like, what's your reaction to Cynthia's story about a porch dinner, a community porch dinner?
I mean, I think like most of your listeners, I'm inspired. I love to hear about it. And, you know, it's also emblematic of what we're seeing really around the world right now. I think we've all heard stories about people fighting over toilet paper and defiant spring breakers. And those tend to grab a lot of attention. But there's also really an epidemic of kind behaviors and new forms of social connection popping up all around the world, just like Cynthia's.
I'm curious, is this the norm? I mean, because I feel like the news media tends to focus on the epidemics of bad behavior during disasters or crises. But are we missing what the real story is? Is the real story one of communities coming together?
Both stories matter. But I think that absolutely the coverage of this type of event can be hugely lopsided. So there's a great book by Rebecca Solnit called A Paradise Built in Hell that is evergreen and super relevant now. She goes through various disasters in history, the 1906 earthquake here in San Francisco, Katrina, 9/11. And she talks about how news coverage and also media portrayals of what those events might look like sort of describe panic and mass violence. But in fact, if you look at the historical record, those disasters produced these pop-up grassroots communities of mutual aid, people pouring out of their homes to help one another, just like we're seeing now. Well, except now people are staying in their homes.
But maybe, you know, fulfilling what the true purpose of technology should be and finding ways to stay connected that way. But as director of the Social Neuroscience Lab at Stanford, Professor, I just wonder, I mean, are we hardwired actually for this?
I think that we are hardwired for all sorts of different behaviors, but absolutely Social connection is one of them. I believe you talked with Vivek Murthy on Monday, and he talked about how, you know, we are sort of, from our evolutionary past, sort of it's baked into our nervous system to be together. And I think that there's a special thing about disasters, which is that it uncovers some of what's underneath, right? So, for instance, we have this kind of tidy, comforting fallacy that we're all free agents, especially in individualistic cultures. We tend to focus on what we can do as single people. But when there's a disaster, it doesn't affect just one of us or some of us. Especially a pandemic like this one shows us how much we have in common. And, you know, we recognize our shared fragility, which is also our shared humanity. And we realize how much we are and have to be in it together.
I mean, basically, you're describing what I think is one of the defining features of humanity as a species, right? It's pro-social behavior. And that's one of the things that's made us quite successful as a species, is it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we are, despite what you read in the news, we are the world champions of kindness and of empathy in the animal kingdom. I mean, we can connect with people, not just who are in the room with us, right? We can feel for people around the world who we read about, whose suffering we encounter through media portrayals. We can empathize and care for fictional characters who never existed and never will. The sheer range of our capacity for caring is phenomenal. And right now, I think we see people all around the world flexing that capacity.
Can it last?
I think it can. I hope it can. It has to, in a way. I mean, most disasters are very punctate. You know, they last minutes or hours or some of them seconds. This is so different because we're all in this collective experience. Sort of, we've frozen and rethought what family and work and culture mean, and we're all going to be doing this together for a long time, suffering together and connecting, hopefully, with each other. And long after COVID is no longer a pandemic, we will still need each other more than we do than we have before because of the economic sort of implications. So I hope that it can last. I think it has to.
Well, we are talking this hour with Jamil Zaki. He's a professor of psychology at Stanford University and author of The War for Kindness. And we're discussing how kindness is sort of erupting all over the place between friends and family, neighborhoods, and entire communities, and why that's particularly important now and how to make it last. So we'll have a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about nurturing a different epidemic, an epidemic of kindness in the midst of the global pandemic of coronavirus. I'm joined today by Jamil Zaki. He's professor of psychology at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab. He's also author of The War for Kindness, Building Empathy in a Fractured World. Oh, and Professor Zaki, you know what? I didn't ask you at the get-go how you're doing, because this is something we've been trying to do with all of our people who are kind enough to join us during this time, and we just want to start it with a check-in. How are you doing?
Oh, thanks, Meghna, and please call me Jamil, okay. By the way. We're fine. I think like everyone, we're trying to muddle through. We have two preschoolers, and of course, we're sheltering in place. So we're trying to create a homeschool situation for them on the fly while still working when we can. And so, you know, it's been bumpy. There've been a lot of tantrums, and sometimes the kids get upset too. But we're also, you know, concerned, like everyone, about family members, you know, near and far. But, you know, we're trying to be grateful for being together and being relatively healthy. How are you? How are you and your family doing?
We're doing very well. Thank you for asking, Ala. We're doing well, and same situation, trying to figure out sort of a on-the-fly homeschool. speaking of kindness, I think one thing that I'm learning is the importance of being kind to oneself and actually allowing the possibility to discover how much can be done when you say, you know, it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be good enough right now. And good enough is actually pretty good. So I'm learning a lot.
I think that there's a recognition in my corner of science that compassion starts at home. We need to begin often by being compassionate towards ourselves, which sometimes is harder than being compassionate towards others, because, you know, we tend to have really high standards for ourselves and be less forgiving of our own failures than we would be of the failures of someone we love. And so, you know, I think one of the things that's so important in a moment like this is, you know, to be there for each other. And also, like you're saying, to be gentle with ourselves and to realize that, you know, our typical ambitions will not proceed apace. We will not get done everything that we typically would get done. And in fact, that would be pretty weird, because right now it's I think, in a way, not about our individual ambitions. It's about our collective ability to survive and get through this.
Yes. And if anything, this is a moment that has reminded me that it should always be about our collective ambition. So we'll come back to that in a second, Jamil. I have to say, when we put out a call over the air yesterday for On Point listeners to share their stories of kindness with us, it really produced a great wave of responses. So I just wanted to play a couple of the voicemails that were sent to us from across the country. So first of all, this is Larry. He's from Bay City, Florida. He is an Uber driver, but he told us that he switched up his routine a little bit lately.
In between trips, I have reached the decision that what I do is I help the shut-ins. If they need something or can't find what they need, I find it and pick it up for them. All I ask in return is, if they're able to, they can just pay me for the cost of the merchandise. If they can't pay me, they can always pay it forward. Just stay safe and be happy out there and help your neighbor. If you can spare it, share it.
Larry, I feel like we ought to be making bumper stickers of that saying right now. If you can spare it, share it. So that's Larry from Bay City, Florida. Gregory also sent us a voicemail. He's from Staten Island, New York, and he has needed a little bit of help recently. And then he told us about how a stranger stepped in.
A few days ago, I had to shop at a local huge grocery store. And, of course, I got 2 or 3 weeks of food. And I wound up with these bags at the end of the shopping aisle. They were starting to fall through. I was thinking, how on earth am I going to carry all this stuff home? And this guy out of nowhere said, listen, I can ride you home. I said, oh, I can get a cab. He said, no, let's just do it here. Go ahead. Then he took me several blocks with all those bags of groceries, no questions asked. It was great. I was very grateful for that act of kindness.
That story from Gregory, who sent it to us from Staten Island, New York. Jamil, you know what? These are all very inspiring and heartwarming. But just as a reality check, though, I mean, at the beginning of all of this current new normal for us, we did hear stories of people who were acting selfishly, that panic buying, the hoarding. Folks probably heard that story of the fellow who hoarded like thousands of bottles of hand sanitizer because he wanted to sell it at a markup. I mean, that is still part of the initial response in a disaster, isn't it?
Of course. Yeah. And again, you know, I think disasters and any sort of existential threat like we're going through sort of get under our surface and show what people are made of. And people are made of a bunch of different stuff. And some of our impulses, especially when we're driven by fear or panic, are to focus on our immediate survival needs to the exclusion of anything else and anyone else. But I do think, as you're alluding to, there's another side to us as well, which is when we are stressed, we also want human connection. And one of the ways that we assert that connection is by seeking out support and providing support to other people. So, you know, I think that as we were talking about earlier, you get a lot of media coverage for hoarding hand sanitizer. But one thing, if you want to stop panic scrolling through Twitter, is to just search the hashtag #CovidKindness. And I think there you see the prevalence of the opposite of that type of behavior, right? So, you know, pertinent to this, to the Uber driver who called in, there's so many cases like this. In fact, you know, you might not typically think of spreadsheets as inspiring, but Vox just came out with an article yesterday about all the different Google spreadsheets that are popping up in neighborhoods around the world with standing offers from younger, able-bodied people to just help in whatever way they can their neighbors who might be older or immunocompromised or otherwise vulnerable. Mm. There's just acts like this all over the place all the time. And like previous mutual aid campaigns after other disasters, they're grassroots, they're bottom up, they just happen. And I think they say something deep about the human spirit, especially in times of adversity.
Yeah. So that hashtag was COVID kindness. Wow. I've put Twitter down a lot recently. So that's thank you for giving me something positive to actually search for on Twitter. But I'm going to do a shameless plug here. There's an entire podcast that for many years has been seeking out stories of kindness. And that podcast is produced right here at our home station, WBUR. It's called Kind World. And we're joined now via Skype by one of the co-hosts of the Kind World podcast. Andrea Swahe joins us. She co-hosts Kind World along with Yasmin Emmer. Andrea, it's good to talk with you.
Hi, Magna. It's so good to hear from you.
On most days, Andrea and I actually don't sit all that far apart from each other, but she's been working from home diligently. So first of all, tell us, what kind of stories have you uncovered in the Kind World podcast, Andrea, over the past week or so?
So this week on Tuesday's episode, so we release on Tuesdays, we did an entire our first segment was all about exactly what Jamil just mentioned, the hashtag COVID kindness, right? And so this was all about what Yasmin and I are seeing happening in our community. So I'm here in Boston, Yasmin is in Cambridge, and you know, we're recording the show from our separate apartments, but we were able to do some reporting about just like Jamil said, about mutual aid groups, some businesses that are helping each other out and their neighbors. And we just found some really beautiful, just really inspiring moments that neighbors are sharing with each other and kind of coming together, you know, that notion of like alone together. Mm-hmm. So helping each other through this in ways that seem really small, but make a huge impact in each other's lives.
And so you've got, for example, you spoke to someone named Jerry. What did Jerry do?
Yeah, Jerry Medina, she is one of the founders of the mutual aid group of Jamaica Plain and Roxbury. So those are two big neighborhoods here in Boston. And she was one of these people who started these like Google Sheets and Google Docs. Uh-huh. And what they are basically one sheet is what people can provide. And then the other is what people are asking for. So, and these are they're hyper local. So these are people in her neighborhood. There's also kind of like designated people in the neighborhood reaching out to people who maybe don't use Google Sheets, who aren't super, you know, internet savvy, to kind of create like text groups or phone groups so they can always keep in touch with each other in case they need something.
And so it seems as if some of the people that have responded to Jerry, they've opened their homes to students who need housing after so many of the local schools and universities in the Boston area, of which there are a lot around here, had to close during the virus. So Andrea, I just want to play a little bit of tape of what Jerry told you.
You know, it was like within not even an hour, I think, that we saw this person step up and offer this to the student. That's why I think this is such a powerful way of practicing community. It's like been the nicest thing to observe during this entire time.
Hmm. So that's Jerry. She spoke to Andrea Aswahe for the Kind World podcast. Andrea, I'm curious, did Jerry tell you what a difference being part of like this sort of solutions-oriented acts of kindness, what difference it's making to her and her experience of this sort of global crisis we're all going through?
Yeah, you know, I asked her what kind of inspired her to start this, because this is no small feat, right? But she said, you know, she's young, she's healthy, she's capable, and she felt this is the right thing to do. And coincidentally, she's also a part-time public health graduate student. And so she said that this is basically practicing what she's learning, kind of putting into practice everything that she is learning in the classroom. And so she said that it's been very humbling to see this play out in front of her, that she feels very privileged to be able to be one of the founders of this group, and that it's really helped her anxiety and worry around this to be able to do something and to see her neighbors come together in this way.
I see. So, Jamil, can you talk about that for a second? About the anxiety reducing power of being proactively kind?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so it turns out, you know, we tend to think about kindness as something that you do for other people, like a transfer where one person sacrifices so another can benefit. But thankfully, well-being and happiness are not zero sum. And it turns out that when we act kindly, we also benefit, right? Including sort of becoming happier when we give away time and money, but critically for a moment like this, also reducing our own stress and anxiety through pro-social kind behaviors. So I think you see a lot of people sort of dealing with their own sense of helplessness by doing for others. And when we help others, we actually can sometimes discover strength in ourselves that we haven't seen before. In fact, a lot of people who go through trauma sort of turn around, whether it's, you know, whether they've experienced assault or war or other types of trauma, they often turn around and help others who have gone through those same experiences, and that helping helps them recover and grow from their own adversity.
Oh, okay, so Jamil and Andrea, hang on here for a second, because we're going to go to Vermont now to hear another story of community kindness. Moira Daly joins us there from Burlington, Vermont. Moira, thank you so much for joining us. And what are you doing? What's your community doing that is inspiring kindness?
Oh, it's wonderful. So I'm a volunteer with the Lyric Theater Company. It's a longstanding theater group here in Burlington. And they recruit about 400 volunteers to do the two productions they put on every year. And so I'm a newbie to this, but again, it's a longstanding group of women who get together to sew to make the costumes. They call themselves the Costume Goddesses. And we've been meeting since about the end of January, Monday, Thursday evenings, Sunday afternoons, and we get together and there's this wonderful banter and sense of community that's in the workshop. So when the production was suspended, not canceled, it's just been suspended for now, there was the emails that we often get were continuing to circulate, and one woman put out a challenge to say, okay, ladies, here's our chance to finish up some of the longstanding projects we all have, and hers was to finish for her grandson a project she'd started for her son about 36 years ago. So that was sort of the spirit of the communication. And then earlier in the week, she sent out an email to say, look, let's rally here to make masks. So there was some patterns circulating, and then we were tapping into the resources at the actual workshop, and then people were sharing the resources that they had. So that's, you know, that's been, again, sort of this collective community that's long established rallying to sort of help in this current need. Now, just to be clear, these are being used by community members. We have a doctor on the committee who said, you know, these don't meet the criteria for personal protective equipment. But again, there was a call out from some community members to say these could be worn, you know, again, by people in the community. So,
right.
But Lyric stands ready to help us if they can. And so, yeah, we've got it's a wonderful community that has really rallied here.
And what difference do you think it's made to the community? What impact has that had on the community?
Well, again, this theater group started from pretty humble beginnings about 40 years ago, and they've become one of the biggest theater groups in the country. And so, again, it has a strong presence in the community. And I think that, you know, this this group of women, again, as I say, I'm humbled to be newly represented among them. But they just have this strong sense of community, and I think it filters out to the rest of the area.
Do you think, Moira, that this is something that's going to just become a part, maybe not mask making, but this type of continued togetherness is going to be something that will stay as a characteristic of your community?
You know, I certainly have to hope so. Everything that I have seen has just been so inspiring. I've the network of women that are involved in so many other volunteer efforts. I've seen the greater good in humanity through all of this. I mean, it's alarming, it's frightening, and it's certainly reaching our community. But I really feel like, again, it's given pause, and it's given people opportunities, or people are creating opportunities to give back. And it's just inspiring. And I have to hope that in the theme of your show today, that really this is our greater good, and we're rising to the occasion.
Well, Moira Daly joins us from Burlington, Vermont, part of a sewing group that's making masks for her community. Moira, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Andrea, you have been looking for stories of kindness for a while for the Kind World podcast. Does it feel different right now? I mean, because sometimes I'll be honest, you guys have to work pretty hard to get stories, but it's like they're popping up everywhere now.
They are. But, you know, I think we're seeing kind of the seeds are being planted right now for tremendous kindness. We're seeing these, you know, groups kind of taking form and helping each other. And I think I know this may sound very Pollyanna, but I really think that we're going to see just how powerful these groups can be in the long run, because we're really bringing these people together. And, you know, I have been so impressed at the amount, just like you said, the amount of people that have been sharing their stories of kindness all over the internet. So we've really been tracking everything on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of that. It's been great.
Well, Andrea Aswahe is co-host along with Yasmeen Amer of the Kind World podcast. Check it out in your podcast feed. Andrea, it was really great to hear you. Thank you for being with us today. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Folks, tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about how communities of faith are responding during the global pandemic of coronavirus. So want to know if you are a member of a faith community, how have your religious services been going? Have they all moved online? And what's that been like? And how are you maintaining your sense of community even as we're asked to stay physically apart? So we're going to be looking at faith in the time of coronavirus, and we want to get voicemails from you. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Well, today we are talking about kindness, both as a pro-social behavior for us as a human species and why it's so important now during a time of crisis. And I'm joined by Jamil Zaki. He's a professor of psychology at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Social Neuroscience Lab. He's with us from San Francisco. And Jamil, I just want to share another voicemail that we got from a listener sharing a story of kindness. This is Brenda from Lodi, Wisconsin, and she's calling attention to the actions of a very thoughtful, creative teacher in her community.
schools here in Wisconsin were hurriedly closed over the weekend, such that teachers and students did not have a chance to process and say goodbye. So this amazing kindergarten teacher, Carrie Rashid, together, I believe, with the help of her self-isolating teenage sons, proceeded to reach out to each of her kindergartners by painting and placing a yard sign at each of their homes. The signs in big, bold, brightly painted letters read, "I miss you," together with the name of the student. Each yard sign also contained a personal note from Ms. Rashid saying that she loves and misses them, together with a painted image of the sign language hand symbol for "I love you." The photo and images of these kindergartners standing next to their yard signs made for them by their teacher are beyond heartwarming.
Wow. So that's from Brenda from Lodi, Wisconsin. Jamil, what do you hear in that story? Because there are so many different forms of community that have been disrupted because of the physical distancing that we need to be, you know, participating in. That, like, schools are one of them, which are often one of the best vehicles for teaching kindness as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. God, that's a beautiful story. And I do think that, you know, we're not just disrupted right now as individuals, our communities are also being disrupted. But I think that, you know, a couple of things about that story. One is that it shows how we can reconstitute those communities even while we're physically apart. I love that, you know, as much as I love digital kindness and the way that it's popped up during physical distancing, I love how analog and old school that teacher's strategies are. There's another thing that this brings to mind, which is that, you know, again, our communities, especially schools, are where we learn culture. We learn what is expected of us. We mm-hmm. learn how to behave by watching others. And, you know, but one thing that I see in this story, and really I want to also give a kudos to Andrea and Kind World, is that we also create culture by sharing our stories in broader communities. And so, you know, people are a herd species. We do what other people do, especially kids, but also adults. We conform. And I think that when media portrayals focus on cruelty and selfishness, those behaviors, we start to feel like those are the norm and we have to sort of fall in line in order to fit in. But likewise, kindness is contagious as well. My own research demonstrates that when people learn about other people who are behaving pro-socially, when students in middle school learn about the empathy of their peers, they adopt it as well. They become motivated to share it. And so, you know, I often say that we should make kindness loud so that it becomes magnetic. And I think that what we're seeing in this proliferation of stories around the world is a chance to realize how common empathy and kindness are, and then to make those the new cultural norms.
Okay, so I want to share one more story of kindness that's come to us from an On Point listener. Asa Norris is with us from Niantic, Illinois. And Asa, what act of kindness did you want to share with us?
Well, in our community, we're kind of a small rural community, and I'm immunocompromised and stuck in, so I feel helpless. And so I started baking bread and doing sourdough and taking the sourdough starter and a fresh loaf of bread with directions to neighbors and leaving it on their front porch and asking them to go ahead and make their own bread and then share a loaf with another neighbor. And so there's about 10 of us right now in our community who are all baking bread every day, taking it to another neighbor and hoping that those neighbors continue to spread. So we're now in three communities around us in Decatur, Illinois. We've got some friends doing it in Niantic and down in Moequa as well. And it's been kind of fun to do. And, you know, smelling home-baked bread in your house is so yummy. So it's been a good thing to do.
I love this. Paying it forward with fresh home-baked bread. I love this idea. But Asa, had you and members of your community been doing this before even?
Yeah, we've done it in the summer. I'm a retired teacher and a school administrator, and we love to bake and can and things in the summer and pass on to friends and neighbors who live rurally and kind of struggle because they're not in a big metropolitan area where mm-hmm. there's a lot of food banks and things. So we tend to share our eggs and garden things. And so at this time of year, it's still pretty nippy in Illinois.
Yeah.
And so the baked bread seemed like a wonderful thing to do. And I was making so much, my husband was worried about his weight gain for the winter, and was like, get it out of here. And he was like, hey, why not? And so that's what we're doing out here in Illinois.
Well, Asa Norris in Niantic, Illinois, with basically a terrific bread baking circle. Thank you so much for sharing that story with us, Asa.
Yeah, thanks. And you guys have a blessed day.
You too. Okay, well, so Jamil, look, these stories are all inspiring and heartwarming. But I do want to focus for the last portion of this conversation about the big question of whether what we're seeing is something that can last. Because when we're talking about kindness as a fundamental expression of pro-social behavior of humanity as a species, it makes a lot of sense that we would see it in the midst of disaster, right? Because when survival is on the line, we work together as a species, it increases the probability of survival. The question is, what happens when that immediate threat recedes? So, I mean, you in your book, The War for Kindness, you've got some great examples of how very quickly when, quote unquote, real life settles back in, empathy can start ebbing away. I mean, there's a great experiment that you quote about when students were asked to write an essay, for example, about the parable of the Good Samaritan.
Can you
tell us that story? Because it's really revealing, I think.
It's a classic study by Dan Batson and John Darley where they asked seminary students at Princeton to write a sermon on the parable of the Good Samaritan, which for listeners who don't know, is a story about someone helping a stranger, you know, basically engaging in an act of compassion. And so they write these sermons and they're then told, okay, you're going to deliver the sermon at a building across campus. And sometimes they were told, you've got plenty of time, just amble over at your leisure. And other students were told, oh my gosh, you're late. People are waiting for you right now. So they were basically stressed. And so they're either walking or sprinting, I suppose, across campus. They get to the building where they're supposedly going to deliver the sermon. And there's someone sitting in the doorway who's clearly struggling. Maybe they're homeless. Maybe they're sick. They kind of cough and lean forward. And that person is not really just there sitting there. They're an actor who's part of the study, whose job is to write down whether the seminary student stops to help them. And what Batson and Darley found was that when students had lots of time, when they weren't stressed, they helped about 70% of the time. But when they were in a big rush, they only helped 10% of the time, which is the irony is so rich, right? I mean, it's basically, I'm sorry, I can't stop to help you. I'm too busy giving a sermon about how important it is to stop and help people. So, I mean, absolutely, right? Our deep sort of capacity for kindness that you have called out beautifully during this episode is there. And it comes out, as you say, during times of collective struggle. But oftentimes, when those struggles recede, the lines that divide us reappear. And we just go back to business as usual. And I think there are a lot of us who probably wish that we could go back to business as usual right now. I'd love to go to work and teach my students live. I'd love to go to a restaurant. I think a lot of us would love to put this moment behind us. And I hope that in some ways we can resist that urge, because there's so much that we're learning right now about our community, about our collective goodwill, that I think we should try to keep with us. And one more thing that I'll say is that, you know, a lot of what I write about in my book is the idea that empathy and kindness are not traits, they're skills that we can work on. And so the length of the coronavirus pandemic is going to be one of the hardest parts about it. But it's also an opportunity to try to take this kindness that we're expressing and hearing about and turn it into a habit.
So can you talk to us a little bit more about that? Because, I mean, was it presumed at one time that empathy was something that was sort of an inborn trait and certain people were just naturally more empathetic than others? Because you're obviously arguing, and you have been for many years, against that theory of human empathy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of parts of human nature that we once thought were trait-like and fixed. So we thought that the brain stopped changing after you turn 18. We thought that your level of intelligence was fixed for life, your personality and your capacity for empathy, right? We all think of saints and psychopaths and feel like they were just born that way and they'll die that way. And likewise, we might feel as though we have some level of empathy and it's never going to change. But in fact, all of the things that I just mentioned are partially genetic, but also can change through our behaviors and our experiences. Our brain continues to change. If you play the guitar for several years, your brain will remap to sort of give more neural real estate to your fret hand. You know, every year of education you have will increase your IQ by a point, changes that will last for your lifetime. And our experiences change our level of empathy in the long term as well. One of the types of experience that most changes people's empathy, changes it reliably, is adversity. Mm. So people who go through real long-term hardships, whether it's a trauma like an assault or a chronic illness or living through wartime, these folks actually can develop greater capacities for empathy. It's something known as altruism born of suffering. And those changes last for years. So there was one study done over in your neck of the woods at Northeastern by Daniel Lim and Dave DeSteno. They basically measured the number of really deep adverse experiences people had lived through in their lives in the past several years. And then in a laboratory study, gave these people a chance to step in and help a stranger, kind of like the Good Samaritan study. And what they found is that people helped overall, but the people who had been through the most helped the most, even if their adversity had occurred years earlier, right? So, I mean, I think we're all going through adversity now, and the opportunity, and I would say the responsibility we have, is to ask ourselves, how can we take what we're learning from this adversity and together bring it into the future?
Yeah. I'm wondering if, I mean, you're talking about the opportunity, a kind of an amazing opportunity in the midst of this crisis to form a brand new habit of mind, right? One that makes acting pro-socially and proactively being kind as something that, like, it's an unconscious thing that we all do all the time. Is that going too far?
Not at all. Okay. That's exactly what I mean. Our first responses to situations are about those, you put it beautifully, habits of mind. And I think that, you know, one of the great things about understanding that empathy is a skill is that we can work on it. You can sort of go to an empathy gym in your mind and sort of try to make sort of your first response to situations one where you think about other people and try to really meet them where they are. Okay. And
can I just jump in here for a second? Because we've got about 2 minutes left. Like, practice that with me right now. What would we do? How would I make that my first response?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to do is to sort of practice a mindful approach to sort of interactions with other people. We often have things that other people bring up for us, anxiety or anger, and we can often pause instead and ask, what is this person going through? Why might they be behaving the way that they are? And that simple question, that simple pause, can often help us access empathy that might be lying underneath our stress or anxiety. For listeners who are interested, I do have a set of kindness challenges that sort of directly related to your question, sort of ways to practice kindness that I think are more relevant now than usual, that are on my book's website. But there are lots of ways to do it, probably more than we have time to talk about now.
Well, we'll link to those. We'll link to your website at onpointradio.org. But Jamil, maybe, look, I don't want to throw a bucket of cold water on this because I have loved this hour. But I do wonder, when we eventually, whenever that might be, when we might be able to relax a little bit from our state of awareness around coronavirus and people start yelling at each other on TV again and we are worried more about getting our kids to school on time and all of the sort of trappings of daily life return in whatever way they will, do you really think that this groundswell of kindness can stay with us? I'm feeling not so hopeful.
I don't know whether it will or not. I believe it can. The question is, what type of choice will we make about the future? I also know that we will need it. I mean, we're not going back to normal for a very long time. The cultural scars and economic ramifications of this crisis will stay with us for years. People will continue to need each other more than ever. And if we try to go back to our hyper-individualistic sort of me-first culture,
Yeah.
A lot of people are going to suffer for a very long time. So the question is, if we still need each other more than usual, can we keep helping each other more than usual? I think we have to.
Well, Jamil Zaki, professor of psychology at Stanford University and author of The War for Kindness, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
You know, we're going to go out today with a little music from a Facebook group called Quarantine Sing-Along. They sing along together, several thousand members from different continents every day. And today we're going to hear a montage of people singing Happy by Pharrell Williams. This is On Point.
Clap along if you feel like happiness is a truth. Clap along if you know what happiness is to you. Clap along if you feel like that's what you wanna do. It come bad news, talk and listen there.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.